The impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump continues for a fourth week in Washington. And so far, the White House has decided not to play ball. Last Tuesday, White House counsel Pat Cipollone submitted a letter to the House of Representatives calling the impeachment inquiry unconstitutional and saying that the administration would not participate. The New York Times called the White House's position one of the, quote, most extraordinary assertions of executive authority in modern times. At campaign rallies in Minnesota and Louisiana last week, 2020 presidential candidate Trump took his usual shots at his political opponents and had this to say about the inquiry.
The radical Democrats' policies are crazy, their politicians are corrupt, their candidates are terrible, and they know they can't win on election day, so they're pursuing an illegal, invalid, and unconstitutional bullshit impeachment.
Despite the president's feelings about the inquiry, a federal district court in Washington, D.C. dealt him another blow when they upheld a subpoena from the House Committee on Oversight and Reform seeking his financial records. And finally, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer, may be under investigation by federal prosecutors in Manhattan for his dealings in Ukraine. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we're going to break down the impeachment inquiry on President Trump and how the White House's aggressive strategy will affect the inquiry moving forward. With us today is Michael Shear, a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Michael, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, happy to do it, always.
We also have Anita Kumar, a White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Keith, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Keith. How unprecedented is it for the White House to send a letter saying they will not be coordinating with the House on their impeachment inquiry?
It's pretty extraordinary. On the one hand, you wouldn't expect the White House to be totally enthusiastic about helping out the impeachment process, and so you expect them to be a little resistant. But the tone of that letter, the kind of arguments it stakes out are really very extreme, and the efforts that the White House engages in to try to dictate to the House how exactly an impeachment inquiry ought to proceed are really far out of bounds of what the White House ought to expect is within its own prerogatives and really interferes with how the House runs its own business.
Anita, haven't we seen this before? I mean, when Attorney General William Barr was held in contempt for defying congressional subpoenas, remind us again what happened then.
Yeah, I actually wasn't really that surprised by the letter. So remember, when the Democrats took control of the House in January, we have seen now months and months of them asking for things, subpoenaing documents, asking people to testify. And the White House has said no repeatedly for all different kinds of people and all different kinds of documents. So it wasn't that surprising, particularly because of that, and also because the letter, though an 8-page letter from a lawyer, sounded a lot like President Trump's tweets, a lot like what he says on a regular basis about how he's not going to cooperate. And it didn't quite say witch hunt, but it was very much the same tone. And so seeing it in paper was a little bit jarring, but the message has been the same message since January.
And Michael, this isn't, as we've said, the first time this administration has refused to cooperate with similar demands. State Department Secretary Mike Pompeo sent a letter earlier this month to Congress, also refusing to comply. Is there anything that makes this letter from the White House different from any of these incidents that we've just laid out?
Well, I mean, I think the things that we've already talked about here, the scope really was the thing that made it different. Past White Houses have always asserted their prerogative to keep certain conversations between the president and his advisors or certain documents private, and they do that on the grounds of executive privilege by saying that that is a function that is solely reserved to the executive branch and that without privacy, the president couldn't do his or her job. The problem with the letter that Pat Cipollone sent was that it essentially asserted that Article 1 of the Constitution, which gives the power of impeachment process to Congress, essentially was invalid. I mean, the letter essentially argues that Congress had no right to even conduct an investigation and to demand any of this information, which I think most people viewed more as a political statement and a political argument than a legal one. And I think that's why most legal experts that look at it think that while there is a role for the administration to argue that there are some things that have to be kept private, that it was really went way further than previous White Houses have gone.
And to that point, Michael, I mean, now that this letter is sort of a line drawn in the sand, how do you think the House is going to proceed here?
Well, they've already telegraphed what they at least expect to do, which is to say the previous Congresses have tried to litigate these questions, right? They've taken administrations to court. This Congress obviously has taken the Trump administration to court and said, no, you courts, please tell the administration they have to comply. The problem with that process is that it can take a long time. You get one court to agree, then you have to, the administration appeals, and ultimately it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. So what the Congress has said now is, we're going to take a different approach. By and large, when the administration refuses to comply, we are simply going to consider that to be obstruction of the impeachment inquiry, and we're going to add that to the list of charges from which we can create a set of impeachment criteria and then move on. And that will deprive them potentially of some of the information that these documents and witnesses could provide. But I think they believe that that's worth it in order to keep the process moving quickly.
Keith, we hear the term constitutional crisis, at least under this administration, being batted about a lot. And I want to maybe stay away from that and ask you directly, is there anything in the Constitution that will prepare us for what we're seeing right now with the Trump administration's impeachment strategy?
Well, I think we're seeing an administration that's really trying to lay the groundwork for the Senate trial after an impeachment has already occurred in the House, and to some degree for the presidential campaign. The president seems to be conceding that the House is going to impeach him. There's still questions about what all the articles of impeachment are going to look like, but the president's strategy at this point seems to be to focus further down the road, try to make this into a political case, abandon the effort of trying to persuade the House not to actually pursue an impeachment. And then we'll see how well that strategy works out in the Senate and on the campaign trail. It's a particularly aggressive strategy. It offers very little for the Republicans in the Senate to grab hold of, because the extent to which the White House simply wants to denounce the House's impeachment inquiry as invalid, unconstitutional, illegitimate, I think that's an approach that the Senate Republicans, for example, should be fairly reluctant to want to grab hold of. Instead, they would want to emphasize maybe the president has done some things, but they're not really that bad, and as a consequence, don't justify impeachment removal. Maybe there's some disputes about the underlying facts. But to claim that the House's efforts are simply illegitimate is an extreme claim that the Republicans in Congress ought to resist.
Michael, we've talked a lot about President Trump's rhetoric on this show, and I want to ask you, you've been covering Trump and his presidency since the beginning. Have you seen a change when it comes to his rhetoric, particularly at the rallies that he's been having?
Sure. I mean, it's hard to describe the early Trump rhetoric as somehow mild or not very intense. But even given that, I think we have seen a ramp up both in intensity and in frequency, both at the rallies where the speeches are going longer, they're more intense. He's using more fiery language, more aggressive language. And of course, through his Twitter feed as well, he's tweeting significantly more in the last few months than he ever tweeted before, just in terms of the raw numbers. And the numbers of attacks are going up significantly. I mean, the personal directed attacks that increasingly are being directed at members of Congress, especially Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who is the Intelligence Committee chairman who's leading the impeachment inquiry. And I think none of that is an accident. I think all of that is designed, as we've sort of talked about already here, to invalidate the investigation. He is running the same playbook that he ran with the Mueller inquiry, which is to say, to try to invalidate the people and the information that is being arrayed against him, with the hopes that by the time we get to the end, people will see it as an invalid inquiry. And I think that's part of the timing situation on the Hill, where the lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, are hoping to do this quickly to give him less time to complete that mission.
Anita, based off of what Michael was just saying, and in terms of whether or not the president's rhetoric has become more aggressive, particularly under this impeachment inquiry, you know, he mentioned that the president obviously is using a very similar playbook here. At the same time, polls are showing and have been showing for at least the past week that there's growing support for this inquiry among many Americans. Do you think, Anita, that there will be implications for Trump's aggressive rhetoric here on this, whether it's on his supporters? Will it just start to not matter much to people anymore?
I've talked to a lot of people that are, you know, sort of prominent Republicans that are counseling him that talking about Ukraine and what's going on with that, that investigation is just not the same as Russia. These are a lot of people that support the president. They want him to win, but they are saying, look, when the Russia investigation was going on, we felt okay because we knew there was no there, right? There were different things that happened, but they felt confident that he himself, the president, hadn't done anything. But with Ukraine, not only has he made the call to the Ukraine president, he has admitted he made the call. He released, a partial transcript or a rough transcript, and we have all this other information. So there was something that happened. The president claims he didn't do anything wrong. Other people say that it was something wrong. So it just feels like it's very different. In terms of the rhetoric, I feel like last week at these two rallies that you mentioned were almost as sort of the launch of the reelection campaign. Now, I know he launched several months ago at a different rally, but it felt really different to me. This feels like what we're going to see for the next 13 months. And I was talking to Trump supporters or seeing, you know, what they had said about the rallies, and they loved it. They loved that language. You know, I'd add one thing to what Mike said, which is there were more curse words than I remember. He was, you know, swearing, and they loved every bit of it. These are rank and file supporters. These are people that go to the rallies. These are not people in Washington per se. So, you know, those people are going to love this. They are going to continue to be with him, I think. It's people that he's trying to get in swing districts. Remember he was in Minneapolis last week. That's a Democratic area, but he wants to win that state. He was very close. So it's people that are maybe on the fence. They're not going to like that, and that might turn them off. So it can help him in one way, but it hurt him in another.
Keith, are there any moments in U.S. political history that you find useful to think about right now, similar battles between a president and Congress?
Well, this clearly, I think, echoes the battles between the Reconstruction Congress and Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson, of course, was the first president to be impeached, and he found himself at odds with the Reconstruction Congress throughout his presidency. He had been vice president during the second term of Abraham Lincoln. When Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson rose to the presidency. Many thought he was certainly out of step with the Republican Party. Some saw him as illegitimate, and he tended to view the Congress as illegitimate. And so a lot of the Trump's rhetoric now, his stonewalling, his harsh political attacks on Congress, really do feel very reminiscent to the kinds of things that Andrew Johnson also tended to do to Congress and ultimately led into his impeachment.
Bringing it back up to today, Michael, the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is under potential investigation by Manhattan prosecutors. What do we know about that so far?
Well, look, the Rudy is being looked into because of allegations that he was involved in efforts to bring bring cash with Ukraine to the U.S. in a kind of scheme with two associates of his who he had who had connected him to a U.S. congressman that's not named in the indictment but is thought to be Pete Sessions. And all of that is not good for President Trump because it lends a sort of air of criminality to what has up to this point been largely questions of political impropriety. And, you know, there is no indication that President Trump necessarily was involved in some of that, but it doesn't help for the president's political fortunes as members of Congress dig into it all.
Anita, how are people within the Trump administration, at least behind closed doors, reacting to the entire situation? Are they, and specifically, are they supportive of Giuliani?
No, there are a lot of people that think the president should sideline him, just not have him as an attorney or at least get him off the air. He's done a lot of media interviews, as you know, that end up sort of he's contradicting himself. He doesn't quite make sense, or he gets angry, belligerent at the host or someone he's on with. So there are a lot of people saying you need to move on from him and find someone else. And you know, the president was convinced to find someone else in former Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. But, you know, like so many things in this administration, they didn't quite vet everything and didn't quite figure everything out before it was announced. And it turns out Trey Gowdy, by lobbying rules, is not allowed to communicate with Congress to try to influence them. So while he could serve on his team, he can't really do the thing he's there for. So there's been a lot in the administration, in the White House in particular, where they don't really know who's in charge of this. Who's going to respond on impeachment? Is it this, you know, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner? Is it his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney? And what is that response? So what we've really seen over these last 3 or 4 weeks is just the president out there himself pushing back his own response, right? He's talking to reporters and tweeting multiple times a day. And then we have this letter that his, White House counsel's office put together that really reflects what he's been saying and thinking. So, there are people that feel that he needs more staff and he needs a dedicated staff just to respond to this.
Michael, you've been covering this for since the beginning here, and you've covered past presidents. I mean, how does that stand out to you in terms of the lack of, there hasn't been a White House press briefing in months. We haven't seen the president's usual folks coming out and talking to reporters. How do you assess this approach by the president, particularly under this impeachment inquiry?
Well, I mean, look, part of the problem for the president is that he doesn't have a kind of disciplined message strategy. He never has, obviously, but previous presidents, one of the things that previous presidents have always tried to do is to put in place a kind of distance between the press and the president himself, so that when times get tough, you don't put the president himself in the position of having to respond directly and personally to these kinds of allegations. That's what the press secretary has always been for. That's what associates of the president who you designate carefully have always been for. And the president, this president, President Trump, has always rejected that. But now he finds himself in a place where, rather than having a kind of well-oiled, disciplined message strategy and message machine with people who know how to kind of, fight these battles. Instead, he's both doing it himself through Twitter and on the South Lawn of the White House right before he gets on a helicopter, or he's latched on to people like Rudy, who, as Anita says, just aren't the kind of disciplined message people that you would expect. And that's causing headaches not only for President Trump, but for his lawyers who are trying to figure out, how do we craft a strategy against the impeachment inquiry? And that's going to be more difficult because of the way he's designed his messaging.
Michael Shear is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Michael, Anita, and Keith, thanks to you all for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.